Good afternoon, Dr. Rainer Fulmisch. You're a lawyer by training. Your name is linked to a series of action that you've taken against the COVID orchestration. Thanks a lot for taking the time this afternoon to speak to the France Soir readers and auditors. We are going to speak about, your perception of the pandemic, what action you took, on behalf of whom, why, and your view about the international support and cooperation that you seem to have gathered for this action. So maybe a small introduction about yourself and your view on the pandemic, that would be helpful, because I would say the French people are probably not fully aware of who you are. But I think it's very important that you give them this explanation.
Sure. I'm Rainer Fulmisch. I have been a trial lawyer for 26 years now, both here in Germany and in the state of California in the United States. I went to high school in Michigan, and I went to law school in Los Angeles at UCLA. I have part of my family lives in Michigan and in California. Most of the legal work I've been doing is representing, not just by myself, but with my colleagues here in my firm, we've been representing consumers and small and medium-sized corporations against large, in general, fraudulent corporations, in particular, Deutsche Bank, VW, and the largest shipping company in the world, which is Kühne & Nagel. When this whole thing started, my wife and I were in the United States. We spent the time from early February until the end of May at our ranch in Northern California. And I had decided when I got these phone calls from our friends and relatives about how there was a lockdown and all of a sudden people were talking about social distancing and all that, I decided to stay there and wait it out until it's over. But my wife persuaded me to go back because she said, this is probably not going to stop in Europe. And she was right, because very soon after we got these first horror stories from Germany and Europe, the whole thing started in the United States as well. Except there's a major difference. Mask wearing requirements, et cetera, et cetera. It was all there. But the major difference is that most people around where we live don't care. They don't wear masks. They don't care about social distancing. They know that they're being fooled. It's a different story when you go shopping in the larger cities. Then you do have to wear masks. But there's another difference, because unlike here in Germany, where people really tend to attack you in a very aggressive way because you're not wearing a mask, people there leave you alone mostly. So finally, we decided to go back. I didn't know what to make of the situation. I did remember, however, that there was a similar thing that happened years ago, but I couldn't quite remember the details of this. And that's why I called my friend Wolfgang Wodak, who is a medical doctor, and I asked him about what he thought about it. And he explained to me that I was remembering the right thing. It was the swine flu, which is 12 years ago. And he said, it looks very much like the swine flu all over again, because it's the same people playing the same roles, panic, making people panic. The same Professor Drosden of Charité University, the same Neil Ferguson of the Imperial
College
in London, same people. And he told me to take a closer look at what some of the other experts said, because we knew very quickly that the only person who the German government relied on was this infamous, now infamous, Professor Drosden. So he pointed out to me that there's Ioannidis of Stanford University and Michael Levitt of Stanford University, plus a number of German scientists who have a entirely different view of the situation. I looked into it and I said, well, there's too many questions to be answered, and I don't expect the German government to answer them, because I very quickly got the impression that the German government was under the influence of whoever. Then I got in touch with Viviane Fischer. She's a lawyer in Berlin, and she's one of the very few lawyers. I think there's no more than maybe 50 or 100 lawyers here in Germany who really work on these corona cases. Maybe it's 200, but no more than that. She had started a petition asking for a baseline study because she too wanted to know what's really going on. And so we got together and we decided we're going to do what the government is not going to do. We're going to set up a investigative committee. And we called it the Berlin Corona Committee. We got two more colleagues to join us, colleagues whom I had known from my work at Transparency International, which is an anti-corruption NGO. And these other two lawyers, Dr. Hoffmann and Antonia Fischer, they joined us. And since July 10th, we have been looking at four, in our view, central questions, or three rather, questions. One, how dangerous is this? Two, how much damage do the anti-corona measures do? And three, what about the PCR tests? Well, very quickly, and now of course it's clear, it turns out that there's the virus, whatever it is, there's still much discussion about whether or not it's ever been scientifically correct, isolated in a scientifically correct manner. But whatever it is, it's no more dangerous than the common flu. Even the WHO agrees with that. And listen to John Ioannidis. The WHO comes to the conclusion that the infection mortality rate is at 0.14%, roughly the same as that of the common flu. Now, the second question, how much damage do all these measures do, was very easily answered because there is no answer to it, because it's quite clear that this is like World War III and probably worse. A lot of people are committing suicide. A hospital very close to us in California, the John Muir Medical Center, reported, I think in June, as many suicides as they normally report in one entire year. And I do think this is representative for what's going on all over the world. Many people didn't get the medical care that they normally would have gotten because operations, surgical procedures were postponed. All kinds of therapies never happened because the hospitals were, or many of the hospital beds were left alone because they wanted to be ready for the flood of COVID victims who never came. I know this for a fact because I've been talking to a number of people who work here in the hospitals. My sister is a nurse in one of the major hospitals in my hometown of Bremen. So terrible damage, both on the economic and on the health side of this. So the final question was, what about the PCR tests? And when we looked at this, it turns out that there's one major player who's, now it's called the Drosten paper, which was published on, I think, January 23rd. This major player is Professor Drosten, who, as it turns out, is neither a professor nor is he a doctor, because the dissertation that finally was found by the people who had been looking for it for months and months and months, turns out to be a piece that was probably produced in June of this year, but not in 2003 or 2002 as he claims it was. So that got us really interested in this, because if somebody lies about his academic background, then the next question is he telling the truth as far as what he's saying in this now infamous Drosten paper? In this paper, he claims that he had invented a new PCR test, which was capable of detecting infections. In another paper that was published a little later, he claims that there are asymptomatic infections. Now you have to read this together, because what does that mean? If there really are asymptomatic infections, that means that people out there who have no infections whatsoever are dangerous because they may be infectious. If it's not true, then we don't have to worry about that. Up until then, it was quite clear that anybody who didn't have any symptoms is not infectious, is a healthy person. I mean, who goes to see a doctor when they don't have any symptoms? But all of a sudden, this brand new claim stated there are asymptomatic infections. And this is, I think, really important to know, because if there were asymptomatic infections, then it would make sense to be afraid of everyone. If not, then the whole thing collapses like a house of cards. The other thing is, what about the PCR tests? And it turns out that PCR tests, even though a PCR test is a great thing to amplify things that the human eye normally cannot see, it doesn't and cannot tell you anything about infections. The inventor of the PCR test, Kerry Mullis, said this over and over and over again. I listened to all of his videos. Great guy, intelligent, witty, smart, full of humor.
As the doctor from Colorado, yeah?
I think he's from Colorado, could be, but he's an American. Unfortunately, he died last year in August, under some say strange circumstances.
I exchanged with the Colorado University on that as well.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I know that he worked in California for a while. I didn't realize he's from Colorado, but that's quite possible. Great guy. So we listened to, I think in the meantime, over 100 experts from all over the world, scientists, doctors, economists, lawyers. And as far as the scientists are concerned, the immunologists, the biologists, all of them said, no way can a PCR test tell you anything about infections, because the one major problem it has, first of all, it isn't designed and it isn't admitted for diagnostic purposes. The major problem it has that it, even though it can detect even the smallest particle, it cannot distinguish between dead and live matter. I'm probably not expressing myself in a scientifically correct way, but if it detects or if it finds a fragment of a virus, then it doesn't know whether this is from your own body's immune system's fight against the common cold or against the flu some 3-4 months ago, or if this is brand new. And even if it were brand new, it doesn't know if it's infectious, because infection means that somebody is contagious for others. That means that whatever virus is found needs to go into the cell and replicate. So that's the major problem this thing has. It cannot tell you anything about infections, in particular not when the machine which reads the swabs, if it is set at more than, I think, 25 cycles, cycle thresholds is what this is called, because it goes 2, 4, 8, 16,
it's 3, 2. Power of 2, yeah.
Yeah, so what you get is most people agree that anything beyond 30 cycles is totally unscientific and totally unreliable, because it tests positive on almost anything. Now these tests, the Drosten test, was set at 45, same in the United States. And the thing is that his test was promoted and recommended by his pals at the WHO, so that this was to be the gold standard, the international gold standard for detecting infections. To make a long story short, there are neither asymptomatic infections. A recent Wuhan study from, I think, 2 weeks ago confirms this. And even if there were asymptomatic infections, even Fauci agrees that they don't play any role in this whole context. And second, PCR tests can't tell you anything about infections. So what do we have here? We have two blatant lies. These are false statements, and we know that this man made them knowingly, because he's supposedly an expert on PCR tests. And we know that he lied on purpose, because there's an interview with him from 6 years ago. I think that was during the MERS flu, which is also a coronavirus, a different one, but still. And that's when he said that the PCR tests are so sensitive that they test positive to almost anything, and that in many cases it tests positive on healthy people. So he knew what was going on. And even then, he also knew that the mainstream media play a big role in this, because in this interview he said, and you also have to take into consideration, you pointed out, that the mainstream media are causing quite a ruckus, quite an uproar. So that's what's happening right now. All of a sudden we're having him once again claiming that PCR tests can confirm infections and that they're asymptomatic infections. Both of this is wrong. So the next question was, what's happening? What is really happening? If there are no infections, if there are no asymptomatic infections, what's going on? So we arrive at the conclusion, that is our current conclusion, that there's some other agenda being pushed, which has nothing to do with health and everything to do with control and power and money. Money, of course, for the pharmaceutical industry and for the tech industry.
Well, that's thanks a lot for this summary, which is quite comprehensive. And so when you reach those conclusions that there were some other motives, what action did you take? And on behalf of whom?
Well, the Corona Committee is four lawyers plus a number of advisors. One of them is a well-known law professor, a good friend of mine, Professor Martin Schwab. Then there's the immunologist and biologist, Professor Kemmerer of Würzburg University. And of course, we kept, the more sessions we had, and the clearer it became that there's that someone's lying here, the more people kept asking us, what are you going to do with these facts that you're finding out? Are you going to publish a book? Is that it? Or are you going to do something about it? And then a group of lawyers contacted me, a group of tort lawyers here in Germany, who were trying to represent owners of restaurants and hotels. And they said, well, can you help us? Can we have your evidence? And I said, no problem. I can get you in touch with all the experts. They'll probably write you expert opinions, and they'll testify in your cases. Now, what all of us remembered, however, all of us on the Corona Committee, because we had been working in this Transparency International thing, is that it's very, very difficult in a German court of law to find truly independent justices when it comes to individual, basically powerless consumers or smaller corporations going up against these large corporations. Because here in Germany, they have lobbied politicians so badly that they're practically under control of important large corporations like VW and Deutsche Bank.
This is what you would call a regulatory capture or judicial capture, where the institutions are captured by other motives than what they were originally there for?
Yes, that's what I would call this. Of course, there are exceptions to this rule. We heard one of the judges, one of the better known judges here in this country, and he testified before us and he said, you're right, in these cases, it is very difficult to find a judge who is independent enough, for example, to make a decision. If I sued here in the state of Lower Saxony, if I sued VW, then the judge, and this is VW's headquarters here in Lower Saxony, the judge would have to, in effect, decide against his own employer, because the state of Lower Saxony owns 20% of the shares in VW. Same thing if I sue Deutsche Bank in Frankfurt. The judge will always have in mind that this is what the politicians call systemically relevant corporation. I don't understand how a fraudulent corporation can be systemically relevant, but that is what's in their mind. And those politicians who have been heavily lobbied by these corporations, they exert an influence over the judges through the presidents of the courts, who are a blend between a judge and part of the administration. And these presidents of the courts, they write assessments of the judges who are in theory independent, but not really, because if your personal assessment says that you're not really in line with your country's gold and you're not really worried about employment, you're only worried about justice, then you have a problem. So in this way, many judges are not independent. They are independent. That's what the person who we talked to said, if they have a strong character.
And so that explains the system. So did you give this evidence to this group of people, or did they become clients?
Yeah, I gave them to this group of people, but I did another thing. I decided that we will write one complaint ourselves because we have all the evidence. We got it firsthand, and I thought that we probably would be quicker because we didn't have any learning to do. And I also got in touch, and that's another thing that I thought was really, really important. I also got in touch with my colleagues in the United States and California in particular, and with the Canadians, because the Anglo-American system has this huge advantage of what we call class actions. And I also, in the meantime, I learned that the Australians have the same thing, so we're collaborating with them as well. A class action is something that that doesn't exist here in Europe, even though it was invented a couple of hundred years ago by the British, but they don't have it anymore. A class action is something that you can use when you have a huge or a large number of people who suffered damages because one single damaging action. In this case, it's the lockdowns, the Dresden PCR test-induced lockdowns. And that'll be a problem for Mr. Drosten and the people who he cooperates with, the WHO and others who are behind this, because they sold these PCR tests, this Drosten PCR test, throughout the world. He was the first, or his business partner from a company called Tittmoll Bühl in Berlin. They sold this. They're the first movers, which is a huge advantage when you first go into a market. And as far as we know, they sold them in the United States and Canada and Australia and all the other countries. And even if they didn't, all the others, I think there's now 300 or 500 PCR test makers, they all followed his blueprint. And he's the one who claims in this paper, which was never retracted, it was attacked, you probably know this, it was attacked by a group of very well-known scientists, international scientists, and they published a retraction paper because the scientific mistakes that the group around Drosten made in this Drosten protocol, which was published on January 23rd, are so serious that many of the people who are involved in this paper told me that it looks as though the mistakes were made on purpose in order to drive up the numbers of infections, which are really only false positives.
And so the action that you took personally is against the RT-PCR, or?
Yeah, the first complaint that we filed is we're representing our friend Wolfgang Wodak, because he was accused by a group of what is now called fact checkers, which is nothing else but people who are bought and paid for by the by YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, in order to defame people who express an opinion that is not in agreement with the government's opinion, in particular when it comes to COVID and PCR. So these people called him a liar because he explained that PCR tests cannot tell you anything about infections. Now, if they call him a liar, they have to prove that he's a liar. So we're suing them for defamation. And we're explaining in our complaint that PCR tests, as I just told you, except this is much lengthier in the actual complaint, that PCR tests have absolutely no way of detecting if anyone has an infection.
And you're suing in Germany, yeah?
Yeah, that's this first complaint was filed in Germany on behalf of Dr. Wodak. There's going to be, I think today we're sending out another paper, another brief to Drosten himself, explaining to him that he has to retract his ideas, but that he's, even at this point, he is civilly liable for the damages that he caused. We're representing a person from Berlin whose business, it's a karaoke bar, has been closed since March. So he hasn't made any money. And the only relief he got over the months is, I think, 35,000 euros. But rent alone is close to 50,000 euros. Plus, he had to let go all of his employees. So
he has a net loss.
Yes, and absolutely.
Net loss. Absolutely. And you're showing on that basis, on the net loss.
Exactly, yeah. But the most important thing is, of course, to get these class actions started, both in the United States and in Canada, and if possible, also in Australia. How this works is as follows. A person who suffered damages in the United States or in Canada or in Australia because of these Dresden PCR test-induced lockdowns can file a complaint against Dresden, against the WHO, or anyone else who in the United States, Canada, or in Australia claims that the PCR test that they're selling tells you something about infections. Now, if then they explain to the judge that they're not the only ones who are suffering harm, but that there's thousands and thousands of more people who suffered the same kind of damage, they can ask the court to let this case go forward as a class action. Meaning, if the judge decides, yes, this makes sense to be tried as a class action, then anybody who suffered the same kinds of damages can join this class. What the judge will then do is publish this. And if it's going to be an international case, then he's going to publish this worldwide in all the mainstream media so that anyone who suffered damages because of this same illegal action can join the class. They don't have to, but they can. They can still file their own complaints. But the power of this class action is that you have, in the end, you have probably hundreds of thousands, I think even millions of plaintiffs who are all in this one case together, but only one case for the so-called representative plaintiff, someone who suffered typical damages, one case is tried. If this case is won, then everybody else wins too.
And so the German system does not allow you to do that, but you mentioned that you were in contact with some French lawyers or some French people who have experience in exercising law. So are you likely to take any collective action in Europe as well, or utilize some of the alternative legal system in France or in Germany?
We're cooperating with all of our colleagues in Italy, in France, in Spain, Austria, Switzerland, all of the countries from which lawyers have approached us. And they all get everything they need from us. If they want my complaint in English or whatever language, we'll just run it through a translation program and they get it, because the facts are always the same as far as the PCR test and asymptomatic infections are concerned. They're always the same. The law may be slightly different, but the facts are always the same. So you don't have to go and invent reinvent the wheel when we have the facts already.
Good. And we've not talked about treatment have you had any groups of patients or citizens who had some complaints about treatments, early treatments, or whether in the US?
There are other actions that are going to be filed for malpractice, yes. Because we know that in particular when it comes to New York and Bergamo, Italy, which the pictures of these places were shown all over the world in order to scare people, in order to tell them, this is what's going to happen if you don't do as we are telling you. Because they needed these pictures in order to make people panic, put them in panic mode so that they won't ask any questions, but do as they're told. Wear masks, for example. Social distancing, for example. You have to have a lockdown, for example. We know now from talking to doctors from New York and from the United States and from talking to a network of doctors in Italy and in other places that these pictures were staged. and part of the in Italy in particular, because we spoke to a former anti-mafia prosecutor who is now a high-ranking judge. And they have a special unit of prosecutors, anti-mafia prosecutors, who are currently looking into this matter. And it turns out that the WHO in Italy had a person installed in the health system, in the Italian health system, who made sure that Italians were not prepared for a pandemic, a real one or one, a stage one like this one. So what happened at the beginning of this year, what happened in Bergamo is when whatever virus it was, it may have been the flu virus, it may have been something else, but whatever virus it was, when this struck, many people rushed to the hospitals because they were panicking, because that's what they were being told, you're all going to die. So they rushed to the hospitals. They were turned away and transferred to nursing homes because the hospitals were meant to be kept free for those who suffered from COVID. So, and in these nursing homes, they ran into people, older people, of course, this is the oldest population in Europe, older people whose, in many cases, whose immune system was already, wasn't functioning so great anymore. Yeah. On top of this, they had been vaccinated against, I forget what it was, but they had been vaccinated a little while earlier, so their immune systems were even more damaged. And that's what caused so many deaths. Literally the same happened in New York. Many people rushed to the hospitals because, but not all hospitals were overwhelmed, only a few, not all of them. Plus there was this hospital ship, which was anchored in New York Harbor. I think it's called the Comfort. It could have, there's space for 1,000 patients. At least there's 1,000 beds on this thing. And I think it was never used by any more than 20 or 40 patients. So not the entire city of New York was overwhelmed. But many people rushed to the hospitals who, under normal circumstances, probably would have stayed at home and would have said, "Ah, I don't feel so well. Maybe it's the flu. I'm going to stay at home for 5, 6, 10 days or so." Rushed to the hospitals. Then they were treated with hydroxychloroquine, which is a good prophylactic treatment. But when you suffer from this, then it does. It's not such a good idea. A much higher dose than is usually used for treating malaria, because that's what this medication is used to be used for. I think it's still being used for this. They got a much higher dose because a British doctor who advised his colleagues to treat COVID with this higher dose of hydroxychloroquine confused two different medications that sounded alike. So what happened is in New York, there's a high, many people who died there were either Black or Hispanic, which means that genetically they come from countries where there's a high prevalence of malaria. Now, this genetic defect is called, the genetic defect that they have is called favism. It's not really a defect because it's a special protection against malaria, but when it comes to treatment with hydroxychloroquine, it becomes dangerous. 30% of this population, 25 or 30% of this particular population suffers from favism. If you treat them with hydroxychloroquine, these high levels, high doses of hydroxychloroquine, it damages your red blood cells so that the oxygen doesn't, your body doesn't get enough oxygen. And if on top of that, then you give these people oxygen, not through masks, but by through respirators, by intubating them, and it kills them. So that's how a lot of people were killed, and that's how you got these horrific pictures.
Well, that's quite a lot of action. And when will these actions be heard in court?
Oh, we're waiting for a trial date to be set by the court here in Berlin. I know that there's a very, very soon there's going to be a similar complaint to be filed someplace in the United States within the next couple of days, I think. And I know that within the next couple of weeks, a real class action, PCR class action case will be filed in Canada. I wish we had acted sooner, but it took us a while to understand what was going on. And you can't go to court unless you have the full picture. Now we have the full picture. We believe in our opinion, this is a staged pandemic, staged for completely other purposes than healthcare. As I said, this is about money, power, and control over the people. And so this is actually the last step. Collecting damages should be the last step. What we're all working on right now, because we have to get our priorities straight, is to we're filing criminal complaints and administrative law complaints in order to stop the EMA, the European Commission that decides on whether or not to admit these vaccines, in order to stop them from admitting these vaccines, because as we know now, they're extremely dangerous. They're not vaccines. This is genetic engineering.
And Rainer, recently we've heard the Angela Merkel, the German leader, take a different stance with respect to lockdown and impose some additional measures to German people. How are the German citizen perceiving this issue?
Because I think this is a mixed picture. I think she's going too far right now. Both this severe lockdown, which I think is going to start on Wednesday, and the possibility of mandatory vaccinations, maybe indirect mandatory, by not allowing people to fly anymore who don't get vaccinated, by not allowing people to work anymore who don't get vaccinated. This is something that even those who have been quiet up until now, and I think that's about 50% of the population. I think there are about 30% of the population who are completely in line with the government and who, if they had a choice, would wear three or four or five masks on top of each other. But then there's 20% who are of the opinion that there's something seriously wrong and this should be stopped very soon. But 50% of the people, that's what we estimate, are beginning to ask more and more questions. And if I read my sister correctly and other nurses and doctors who I spoke with, at least 90% of the people do not want vaccinations.
And they don't want vaccination, the German government has still not sort of given some early approvals or temporary approvals for any form of medications, such as hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin. Are you also pushing some of your other patients for action against that? Or is this something that's outside of your field of expertise?
Well, I used to do a lot of medical malpractice law when I still worked at the, I got my basic training as a medical malpractice lawyer when I still worked at the University of Göttingen at its Medical and Pharmaceutical Institute. We cannot do everything. So we're meeting tomorrow with a large group of lawyers, and we're going to decide who's going to do what. Some of us are going to go to administrative law courts. Some of us are going to work with the tort law cases, which is my specialty, and others are going to do criminal law. The thing is, though, these the malpractice cases that I described that happened in New York and in Bergamo, they didn't really happen here, because here in Germany, treatment with hydroxychloroquine didn't happen the way it happened, the mass treatment that happened in Italy and or in New York in particular, didn't happen here. Doctors were a little more careful than they were in some of the other countries. So we don't, here in Germany at least, we don't have these kinds of damages. I think basically the healthcare system seemed to function fairly well. It's changing because doctors are being put under pressure. They're trying to make doctors suppress any doubts that they have about vaccinations. They're trying to make doctors not inform their patients about the dangers of these vaccines. More and more doctors are coming out of hiding and are approaching us, the Corona Committee, through our whistleblower tool. So things are beginning to boil, more or less.
And what about media? Do you get a lot of media attention in Germany?
No. We have the same problem all over the world. The same people who invested their money in the pharmaceutical and technical industry, tech industry rather, invested much, much, much money into the mainstream media to get them under control because they needed them to push this pandemic, to push the panic that they needed for the people not to ask any questions, but to simply go ahead and do as they're told. So we're not getting any coverage. And if we do, it's always negative. We're always Nazis, anti-Semites, tinfoil hats, all that stuff that is probably the same thing all over the world. However, when I wrote up, I just got back from court. When I took a taxi, a cab from the train station to my law firm, the taxi drivers are really smart. They seem to understand everything that all these scientists don't seem to understand. And he said, you know, whenever we read something about you or someone else who is depicted as a right-wing conspiracy theorist, we realize there's something wrong, because if you really were, they didn't have to take so much that they would hear you. They would give you a chance to explain your side of the story. And since they don't, we realize there's something wrong. So this is not quite working the way that they're hoping it would work.
Good. Well, Ryan, I have to say this is a very long interview and very comprehensive. Thanks a lot for taking the time to debrief us on your actions, on your expertise, and the knowledge you've built over the last few months. I'm very, very, very honored to have had you on our channel. I do believe it's very important that we share knowledge across borders, across the globe. And as a media, this is what we endeavor to do, and to inform and re-inform people in a factual manner. And as much as we can, maybe I will ask you at one point to if I can get an access to the document on the RT-PCR, if I can share that with all the other lawyers in France. I'm sure you've done that already. I'm very happy to bring some light onto that. Needless to say, I'm not a lawyer, nor am I a judge, but I think it's very important that we share this knowledge. Like these people can be informed that there are alternatives, narratives to what we were hearing everywhere on mainstream media and from the government initiatives. So I'm very, very thankful for what you've done. And on behalf of the Francois readers, just want to say thank you and have a nice evening.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm very honored.